This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions, producer Jim Minns.
Bail is refused.
You're out of order!
If it pleases the court.
To adopt this affirmation, please say the words, I do.
I do.
Nothing further from this witness.
Given the serious nature of this offence,
this case is dismissed.
Hi, welcome to The Wigs. This is a new monthly podcast exploring and interrogating contemporary legal issues in and out of the courtroom. For the record, we'll be recording the show out of the courtroom. We believe this is the first podcast so far and the only one featuring practicing barristers talking shop. If you're sick of the simplification of complex legal issues in the media and you want to get to the heart of these issues, this is the podcast for you. If you want to learn about law reform ideas and cases challenging the legal status quo, you have come to the right place. Unfortunately, though, I am your host, the non-wig of the group. My name is Jim Minns, some would say the Ringo Starr of this band. You'll recognize me throughout the podcast as the mumbling village idiot who will often interrupt. I'm apologizing now to save you some time later. We are coming at you from Sydney, Australia. Please welcome Emmanuel Kirkasharian.
Greetings.
Stephen Lawrence.
Hi, it's good to be here, Jim.
Fantastic. And Felicity Graham.
Hi, Jim.
I just want to cut in here quickly while the Wigs aren't in the room with me to give you all a rundown of their backstory. Stephen Lawrence practices from Black Chambers and has a statewide practice in criminal and administrative law. When not doing law stuff, he is focused on his duties as a councillor on Dubbo Regional Council. Emmanuel Kirkasharian practices from Forbes Chambers, specialising in serious and corporate crime. He's a member of the Bar Association's Legal Aid Committee, and when not barristering, he's focused on improving access to justice for all. Finally, Felicity Graham is a barrister at Black Chambers. She practices in Australia and overseas with a focus on human rights, police accountability and the criminal law. She is a member of the New South Wales Sentencing Council. When not lawyering, she enjoys making a mean fennel pickle. Now back to the show, beginning with our mission statement.
Well, I guess what we know is that there's issues in the law that are discussed in the media all the time. There's cases that come through that aren't discussed in the media all the time. The point of this podcast is to get the practitioner's point of view, the lawyer's point of view about those things and have discussions about them.
Now, isn't that a problem because, I mean, historically, aren't barristers not supposed to talk about current case law, and doesn't that pose a lot of problems with this format of a show?
Yeah, look, there are certain constraints on us. I mean, we obviously talk in court all day about our cases. We're subjected to a set of rules that our professional association creates. And one of those rules certainly doesn't allow us to comment on cases that we're involved in. So, look, there's certain restrictions I certainly don't intend to breach them. I'm sure the others don't too.
Indeed.
And it's good to have a chance to talk in an in-depth way about legal issues because, you know, we talk in our cases all the time and we see them reported and we see the legal policy issues discussed and we don't often have the opportunity to speak to a bigger audience in an in-depth way about the issues, so it's a good chance, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, let's hope we have a bigger audience for our views. For me, it has a few different purposes. One would be to sort of communicate with a broader audience about these quite interesting and intricate issues in the law, including reform ideas and debates that are going on in the now about how the law should be and how it should change. And then also to tap into an audience of our colleagues and those practising in the law, not just in New South Wales, but in other jurisdictions as well, and promote the discussion and interrogation of issues that then better serves the law and the system overall.
Okay, cool. So that's like the mission of the show?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's also a good opportunity to talk about legal policy or law reform issues that aren't being posed in the context of any particular case, you know, might be before Parliament and so forth, particularly, I guess, as it relates to the criminal law, because I think all three of us have a mixed practice, but we all certainly appear a lot in criminal cases.
Rock and roll. Okay, well, without further ado, let's begin our topics in front of us. So for the viewers listening, we have been in discussion for a few months now working out a topic list. One of the issues that has come up is the decriminalisation of abortion. Tell me, what's going on? What's the issue?
Yeah, so there's a bill that has been before the New South Wales Parliament, and it's coming up again in September, which concerns the decriminalisation of abortion. Currently in New South Wales, it is a crime to have an abortion unless certain circumstances apply in relation to how a doctor perceives a particular set of circumstances in relation to someone who is pregnant. So there's a few kind of different parts to what's being proposed in New South Wales. It's somewhat similar to what has recently been a change in the law in Queensland. But basically what are the key parts of the proposal is that a woman who's pregnant up to 22 weeks, they, under this new law, will have a right to choose to have an abortion without any constraints being put on them in relation to the reasons for it, so long as it's performed by a medical practitioner with that person's informed consent, unless an emergency situation arises. And then there's a new part of the law that's going to deal with what happens or what can happen after the 22-week time frame passes in a pregnancy.
So there's two laws, did you say, or just the one law?
Yeah, so it's part of a raft of changes to the law that will be, you know, there's lots of different sections that will make up the component parts of this reproductive healthcare reform legislation. I think people obviously have different, really different views about this area, and there's built into the legislation a carve out in terms of medical practitioners who conscientiously object to providing this service. But I think one of the things that we've obviously been discussing recently, Stephen, is some of the detail around what the later term abortion proposal is and would mean in terms of the law. So that seems to be a particularly divisive part of the new proposal.
Right, so that's where a lot of the community anger comes from, would you say? Like the late-term abortion element to this particular bill? Because I don't get it. Like, so how late's late? I haven't read the bill.
So this act,
22 weeks.
Yeah, 22 weeks. Line of 22 weeks.
Okay.
I think is generally recognised as the point of viability of the unborn child or the fetus outside the womb.
Possible.
Based on what viability. Definition?
But it... I'm on medical understanding.
Yeah, but even fetuses that are born alive between, say, 23 and 25 weeks have very high chances of having a poor outcome by way of death or some other abnormality or difficulty in terms of their ability to survive, basically. And
it's proposed, though, isn't it, to allow abortions for medical reasons right up until birth. Is that what's essentially proposed?
Yeah, so for abortions post 22 weeks, what's proposed is a doctor in consultation with a second doctor who both need to be of the view that in all the circumstances the termination should be performed, that a termination can occur. And they have to take into account all relevant medical circumstances. The pregnant person's current, future, physical, psychological and social circumstances and professional standards and guidelines that pertain to terminations of pregnancy. But assuming in an emergency situation that a termination is necessary to either save the pregnant person's life or to save, in a multiple birth scenario, another fetus, then you don't need to go through the informed consent procedure and the two practitioner consultation process. It can just be done as an emergency procedure to
So it's not just medical.
It's social as well.
It's a range
That's
of
right. circumstances.
And so I think the real controversy comes from the prospect of someone 2 weeks from giving birth aborting the fetus because of social reasons, which is a potential outcome.
Mm.
And the social reason, like gender selection. Is that right? Is that
So gender selection is the second of the particularly controversial issues that have been raised by the opponent. So the first one generally is late term and the controversy around termination of late term for a variety of circumstances which might just be social. And the second one that's been raised and has been prominent is the spectre of people terminating pregnancy because of the gender of the unborn child.
In other words, in that up to 22-week time frame where there's no constraint on the reason for the termination, then that could be a reason.
Mm.
Yeah, so part of what's been built into this new proposal is a requirement for the Secretary of the Ministry of Health to report on the issue of whether or not terminations are being performed for the purposes of gender selection within 12 months of this legislation coming into force, if it does. So the legislature seems to be recognising that this could be a potential issue that they need to look at further.
And so that's what the hold-up is in the Legislative Council at the moment, right? Because it hasn't passed. It's not law yet. It's still a criminal to get an abortion. It's still a
criminal. Yeah, it's before the
uphouse. Yeah, okay.
I think the hold-up has been more of a political one. I think the government originally was intending to ram it through quite quickly and then Berejiklian came under a lot of pressure to delay it.
Because of these reforms that you're talking about?
Because of these two particular issues have been the ones that have been, I think, sort of, you know, hit particularly hard by the opponents of the bill. And the majority of the Liberal MLA certainly voted against it. And it looks like there's a majority in the upper house for it. But she's delayed it in order for amendments to be discussed and so forth.
I think it's important to note that at the moment, abortion is a crime. But if it's done for medical reasons, and the doctors can sign off on that, and they can show that it was for medical reasons, then it's not. Then that's a defence, right? But they still run the risk of being charged and having to defend themselves. Now, in practice, that hasn't happened all that much of late. I can't think of any specific examples where it has, but I'm sure there's been one
there's
or two.
Some, yeah.
Yeah. But generally speaking, if the doctor has done it for medical reasons, say to save the life of the mother, then that's fine. And it also includes in that, in practice, social reasons insofar as they affect the mental health of the mother. So that's the current state of the law. There is, if this change is going to mean anything, I think it means, at least at the latter stage, that the social factors will play a bigger role in the decision making. But it's interesting from the point of view of legal policy to delegate decisions about whether or not an abortion should occur to a doctor for social reasons as opposed to purely medical reasons.
I mean, I think the other issue that really looms large here as well is that that accessibility to termination services for women is really varied. So you can have a law that either says it's a crime except if a doctor gives you permission, or you can have a law that says it's not a crime up to 22 weeks. You can freely make that choice as a pregnant person whether or not you want to terminate it, and then thereafter with the two doctors' permission. But the reality on the ground is that many, many women and girls in New South Wales, particularly in regional and remote areas, have effectively no access to these type of services. So I think it's, I mean, RU486, which is a drug that was put on the PBS in about 2012, has somewhat changed the landscape in terms of accessibility, because that form of accessing termination services has made it a bit easier to access termination services. But, yeah, there's, I think, a real issue that needs to be kind of more confronted broadly, that, OK, we can write our laws with the expectation that they're going to uniformly affect people. But that's not the reality in this area in terms of how women and girls actually access health services.
It's interesting that because I had a look, the Victorian Law Reform Commission has done, it did an entire inquiry into this thing, into this issue. And they set out a history of it. And in that history, they say that the oldest trace of a law is 3,000 years old. And one of the policy justifications for that law, criminalising abortion, one of the policy justification was protecting the life of the woman. Because at that time, the instruments that were available to conduct abortions were such that the life of the woman was at risk every time. And one can imagine the social pressures that might come to bear upon a woman to have an abortion in those circumstances. We live in an age where that policy justification at least has fallen away.
It has, because it's much more dangerous to give birth than to have an abortion.
Yeah.
Even with our modern medicine that is accessible to many people in Australia. So many complications that can come, especially from a cesarean birth, which is quite major surgery. So, yeah.
I mean, it's a strange state of affairs. Like, you can have your views about the morals and the ethics of it all, but the reality is that abortion in theory is a criminal offence, but in reality is available on demand. So you're here in this state. So you really have a situation where the law is being ignored. And the case law that developed applied the necessity defence, which is a general defence that applies to all criminal offences and says that if it's necessary in sort of emergency circumstances,
like self-defence or something like that.
It's very similar to self-defence.
Okay,
right. And it's been applied to the criminal offence of abortion in a way that is very strained and really inconsistent with the general operation of the criminal law.
So
you have your views about the rights and wrongs of it all, but it's hard to defend the existing situation purely on the basis that it's a law that is being disregarded. And laws that are widely disregarded by reasonable people probably shouldn't be on the statute book holder.
Right. I think that's right. So would it be safe to say,
and probably not because it's coming from me, that this is a situation where a procedure just needs a reclassification, but it's opened up this can of worms that nobody saw coming?
I think that's right. I mean, it's being argued...
I don't know.
..argued on the point of decriminalisation, which is only in one way a sort of prism to see it through, because both sides accept that it's widely happening and will continue to widely happen.
Mm-hmm.
Although it is, I think, reducing in Australia, partly it's theorised on the basis of greater availability of contraception, including long-acting contraceptives. I think the other thing that perhaps is dominating the debate in terms of the opponents is this late-term abortion issue in circumstances where that doesn't necessarily match the reality of the time frames where most abortions are performed. So it's not very easy to get data on this. There is some data from around 2005 or something that the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare looked at, and there's some data from the US that looks at this, but that, and there's some Victorian data as well, I think, that all seems to suggest that the percentage of abortions that occur after about 20 or 21 weeks is 1%. So,
okay,
talking about a pretty small proportion.
Though quite a lot of abortions. The thing that is sort of frustrating about this debate and sort of telling about times is people are sort of choosing their own facts. I mean, I saw an MP the other day in Parliament saying late-term abortions only happen in cases of medical emergency, and there is not support for that in the research that's been done.
Okay.
And, you know, you get into this inevitable debate about, on one side of the debate, you know, it's about bodily autonomy and gender equality, and that trumps everything. And then on the other side of the debate, an unborn child or a fetus is equal to any human being at the point of conception, So there's sort of these two extreme sides to it, and they're choosing their own facts, really, to make their arguments. And I don't know, but surely there's a sort of middle ground that the majority of the community would subscribe to.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's either of those extremes. So I think amendments should probably happen.
Which is going to be my next question. Where does it go to from here, Felicity?
Yeah, I mean, the question for what kind of amendments might be put up, I mean, that will be interesting to see what sort of happens with that. But it seems as though this is a pretty vexed area in terms of the way that drafting has been occurred. I've been looking also at one of the quite recent changes to the Public Health Act in this area, which is about safe access zones around health clinics where abortions are provided. And the policy objective of the changes to the legislation is pretty clear, that it's trying to achieve a situation where...
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Is this an amendment in the law?
Sorry, this is something that's already in the law that was passed...
Last year.
Public access zones are just places on the street that people protest at. Is that right?
So a safe access zone, it's an area within 150 metres of any part of the premises of a place where abortions are provided.
You have to give that space, 150 metres.
It's a no-go zone.
Right. Yeah, so it's that zone is kind of drawn around these places, not in a physical sense, in the sense that you wouldn't necessarily know whether you were in a relevant zone or not.
Yeah.
And then by reference to that zone, there's a number of criminal offences that have been included or created. And, yeah, when you were asking about what kind of further amendments might be made to the decriminalisation law, it just kind of brought to mind this drafting, because it seems pretty clear that the policy objective is to ensure that women and girls who wish to access termination services or other maternal health services, that they can do that safely and free of harassment and so on. But the actual drafting in the creation of these criminal offences goes so much further, in a way that the conduct that is criminalised doesn't have to have anything to do with abortions. So, for example, a mother who's at a hospital where abortions happen to be a service that's provided, is faced with a situation where her son wants to leave the hospital against medical advice. She's trying to stop him from doing that. Trying to stop him from leaving the hospital, she would be committing an offence under this legislation.
And is that because she's obstructing a footpath? Or
yeah, because she's interfering with any person accessing, leaving, or attempting to access or leave the relevant place.
That's funny.
And so
it's poor drafting.
It's really poor drafting, which I think.
How old is this law?
Oh, just last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there something? Is there a provision in there about videotaping on the street as well? I mean, how does that even relate? Because as someone who knows nothing about the law but loves using a video camera on the street, I have been briefed before by non-lawyers that it's totally legal to film on the street.
Yeah, it is generally.
So how does that?
So the offence that's created there is a person must not intentionally capture visual data of another person by any means, without that other person's consent, if that other person is in a safe access zone.
So
there closing of television in a chemist outside a hospital would be illegal.
That's weird. So how the law wins?
So there are some exceptions, like CCTV cameras for security purposes only at the actual reproductive health clinic or hospital or whatever, or premises adjacent to or near that place. Some other exceptions in relation to the actual service providers and so on. There's an exception in relation to police, and then any other person who has another reasonable excuse, but proof of which is going to be on them, and otherwise it's criminal conduct.
What about I was making a short film and we walked into a safe access zone?
Yeah, so knowledge that you're in a safe access zone doesn't appear to be a necessary element of the offence, and that's another kind of really troubling area.
Weird. And this, but so is this tied into the bill?
I think it's tied in the sense that quite extreme views are sort of afoot in this debate. Mm-hmm. And I think those quite extreme views are finding expression in legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And then reasonable attempts to amend or to balance are basically shouted down or defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true, certainly in my opinion, of the current decriminalisation bill.
Mm.
I'm not saying that I disagree with all of it, but I think parts of it are quite extreme. And I think it was the same with the safe access zones. Like, the aim is good, to stop people being harassed and filmed because they're having an abortion. I completely agree with that. But there's not much restraint and balance in the legislation. So I think there's that extreme views finding expression in legislation that maybe draws it together.
Yeah, and I think to successfully draft legislation, like, that's a really difficult skill, I think. And you can come up with a policy objective that you have a broad consensus view for, but actually implement that into legislation can be quite difficult.
I don't know.
But this safe access zone legislation, I don't think really even attempts to engage with the policy objective, which is obviously a very worthy one. But, you know, the idea that if you obstruct or impede by any means a person attempting to access or leave, for example, a hospital, like, your car's parked in the wrong place because you're waiting to pick up your grandma from the hospital and you're blocking someone else from accessing or leaving the hospital, well, you're committing a criminal offence.
Yeah. Would any reasonable police officer pick up on that legislation?
Yeah, look, that's a good question, but I think one of the concerns that I have about criminalisation of conduct that where there is a law that does in fact criminalise the conduct and leaves it to the discretion of a police officer whether or not to take any action. You see in lots of different situations, I think, that results in people who are quite vulnerable and disadvantaged actually facing the consequences of the criminal law.
Street
harassment. Exactly. And so, for example, homeless people lying on the street, lying on the footpath
of a safe access zone, or just in general?
Yeah, so lots of other laws, I think, operate in that way. But I think this law is vulnerable to that kind of abuse.
There was talk at the time that it was before Parliament of a similar law in Tasmania being used against union protesters. And I did try to find out about that at the time because I was quite interested, but I couldn't actually find the source of that. Yeah, that was certainly afoot.
I don't think it is drafting skill the reason why we have these bad laws come out. I think it's because we've paradoxically entered an age where the more complicated things are, the more issues there are underlying them, the quicker they're rammed through Parliament, because the politicians don't want to face the realities of talking about them and dealing with their own groups and saying, look, we understand that's what you want, but here is the other side of the story. And so what happens is legislation is rammed through by whichever side wants to take the hardest approach quickest.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That was a worthy discussion. We're going to move on now. Interesting case to come out of Victoria. George Pell, I think that's how you pronounce it. Georgie Boy. What's Georgie Boy been up to? Where is he now? Who wants to take the lead on this one?
Well, he's in jail in Victoria. He was charged with allegations of sexual assault on two choir boys that was said to have occurred in a cathedral in Melbourne. And he was charged, sort of 3-4 years back now?
Yeah.
Stood trial. I think the first jury couldn't agree and was discharged. And then there was a new jury impaneled, or a new trial commenced. And ultimately, he was found guilty of all the charges. And there's a few notable aspects of the case. I think one of them that is immediately unusual was There was allegations of sexual assault on two choir boys, but only one gave evidence.
Why is that?
The reason for that was that the other had died prior to the prosecution. And one of the other curious aspects of it, which was certainly a feature in the recent decision of the Court of Appeal, was that apparently the mother of that person had asked him before his death if anything untoward had happened, and he had said no.
Mm-hmm.
But the other complainant gave evidence of seeing those things happen to him, as well as the things happening to himself. And ultimately, the jury was satisfied of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. He then appealed to the Victorian Court of Appeal, and that was a widely covered case.
Mm.
And the hearing of the appeal was live streamed on the internet, and a lot of people watched it. And the decision came down last week, I think it was.
Yep.
And there were three judges on the appeal panel, and two said that his appeal should be dismissed. They were satisfied that it was open to the jury to be satisfied that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
The third judge, Justice Weinberg, he formed the view that Pell should have been found not guilty, and that it was not open to the jury to be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt of his guilt. He wrote a dissenting judgment, I think of some 200 pages or more, where he comprehensively laid out why he thought that this was not an allegation that could be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And the real discussion point in the two judgments is about to what extent is it open to a jury to accept a complainant in the face of conflicting evidence, simply on the basis of their credibility and demeanour. So simply on the basis of how they appear and how the jury perceives how truthful they are.
Totally. I mean, I watch a lot of Law and Order, and I thought that you needed to... you couldn't convict someone off the basis of accusations, I guess. Is that the word?
It used to be the case that you needed corroboration.
Okay, which is what this other guy
So... It used to be the case for certain types of offences, particularly mm-hmm. sexual offences,
mm-hmm.
that one person's word was not enough.
Yes.
Right? Long gone. Hasn't been the law for a long, long time.
Really?
Yeah.
So you could be convicted off the basis of one person's accusation against you.
Yeah, plenty of people are.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. And in this case, George Pell was convicted. But you did mention that his case was initially dismissed by a jury.
There was a hung jury, means that the jury couldn't agree.
Okay, so you've got a situation where you had a hung jury in the first trial, convicted beyond reasonable doubt in the second trial, and then upon appeal, Supreme Court judge, is that right, in Victoria?
So three Supreme Court judges on the Court of Appeal of Victoria.
And one saying, absolutely not, it should have been thrown out.
Absolutely.
So yeah. What's George's... I mean, it sounds like he has a legal grounds here to continue fighting this.
Yeah, so I think he has now confirmed that he's going to seek special leave, which is like permission from the High Court to appeal from the Victorian Supreme Court's decision. I'm not sure what kind of grounds of appeal will ultimately be put forward, but the key kind of issue was this question of whether the verdict of the jury was a safe one, a reasonable one. It's quite an interesting feature of the criminal law. I think that at the stage of trial, there's an expectation that usually 12 jurors will be unanimous in their verdict. In other words, all agree on their decision as to guilt. And then on appeal, you can have three judges looking at the case and the question of whether it's open to get to that conclusion. And two minds can say, we think it was open to convict, and one mind can say, no, I disagree, and there's not a requirement for unanimity on That's appeal. Particularly where the question on appeal is not, from the judge's perspective, what I would have done if I were a juror, it's what was even within the ballpark for what was open for the jury to decide based on all the evidence that was presented. And so you've got two judges saying, yep, it was in the ballpark, and one judge saying it was so far beyond what was reasonable that it couldn't qualify for a conviction. I think that's quite an interesting aspect of the law. Obviously, in many situations in appeal courts, judges disagree on different points of law and different results as well. And so classically, there can be dissenting judgments, 2-1 or 4-3 in the High Court or things like that.
You think this is a bizarre, exceptional case, though?
Not so much this case, but just on questions of, say, construction of a statute or even on sentencing, there is this concept of, you know, reasonable minds may differ on the result that you get to or the way that you analyse a case. But we have enshrined in our law in relation to the question of guilt this concept of unanimity and the need for a jury to all agree on it before, and if they can't agree, then it's either a hung jury and it and there's a majority verdict exception in some jurisdictions.
Oh, really? It's 11-1.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And if you think about the concept of beyond reasonable doubt, if someone's able to reason a doubt, then you might think that'd be enough. But it's not enough because if only one of the two judges reasons a doubt and the other two don't, then the appeal doesn't get up.
Yeah.
It only applies in a jury. Like if one juror has a reasonable doubt, although if it's an 11-1 scenario, then no.
No, but if two have a reasonable...
Is your mattress making noises it never used to? Or is it sagging, causing you to... Then it's time to get a new one. Get the best sleep at the best value with a Nectar mattress. Prices start at just $499, and you get $399 in accessories thrown in, a 365-night home trial, and a forever warranty. Go to NectarSleep.com.
Doubt.
Okay, right.
And 10 don't. Then what happens is the jury hangs.
Yeah.
There's no decision made.
Yep.
And there's a retrial that occurs.
And okay.
And there's some of the jury research suggests that, and it's sort of shrouded in secrecy because, of course, you can't go into the jury room and find out what they actually say or how they discuss and reason and so on. And they don't need to be unanimous on their reasoning process, just the result, so they could convict for different reasons. But I think there's quite a lot of research that suggests when a jury is hung that it's more likely to be a more significant split than an 11-1 kind of scenario. It's more likely to be sort of 5-7 or 6-6.
We don't know what the split was the first. You don't get told the split.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. Yeah. So I also read in the preliminary, meaning I didn't really read that much about it because I figured you guys would fill me in. He has a George Pell. No, I didn't do the research, guys. I'm sorry. I know you told me to. George Pell now, has a chance to take this to the High Court. Is that correct?
He's got a chance. So he is going to seek special leave to go to the High Court. So you need permission to go to the High Court.
From who?
From the High Court itself.
Oh, okay.
And that's normally determined either on the paper, so not in court, or three judges in court decide it. I mean, one of the interesting things about the case is that normally you get special leave to go to the High Court if there's a point of principle, so if there's a discrepancy in terms of what the law is. And on one view, this kind of question doesn't necessarily raise any question about what the law is. It's more about how the law was applied.
Yeah.
But I speculate that he probably has quite a good chance of getting special leave because this issue of when and how you can accept a single complainant in a sexual assault case beyond a reasonable doubt is a very contemporary one. And I think most lawyers would agree that it's getting easier to get convictions in front of juries in cases like this.
Because you said earlier it happens many times and there's been many convictions.
Yeah, and the law has been changed in many ways to facilitate convictions in those cases.
Okay.
And also the approach of prosecutors to these types of cases. So, for example, in Pell, one of the features of the case that Stephen mentioned was that the second choir boy who's deceased had told his mother that he had never been abused. And that was something that Pell's legal team said should be given quite a lot of weight. But on the other side, the prosecution said that it should just be put aside completely because this is now a known characteristic behaviour of victims of child sexual abuse. And there seems to be this sort of approach that is increasing where the kinds of factors that you might assess as being something that undermines the credibility or reliability of evidence, things like delaying complaint, denying that something has ever happened, incomplete accounts, inconsistent accounts, and then in relation to the kind of actual alleged event, not resisting either physically or verbally the alleged abuse, or not trying to get help or trying to escape, that these things are being used by the prosecution to suggest that they bolster the credibility of the complainant in circumstances where they're the kind of factors that you might think undermine the credibility. And this idea that because these are common or not uncommon features of, according to some academics, the profiles of some victims of child sexual abuse, that that kind of then can be used, translated into, well, you would expect that, so therefore that, that bolsters their credibility.
That's strange.
I think there's also an increased understanding about how brazen offenders can be. So, for example, in the past, I mean, I certainly...
Particularly in relation to children.
Yeah, but I know of cases, I've been involved in cases where it's been alleged and then proved that teachers have sexually assaulted children in classrooms. Now, I think in the past, juries might have been more willing to accept a submission that that's a wildly improbable thing, whereas now there's an increased understanding that these things happen.
Okay.
And that was an important part of the Pell case, because he was said to, in respect to the first offences, to have committed the sexual assaults in a vestibule area just off the cathedral immediately after the conclusion of a large mass with a lot of people there. In a sort of moment in time where there could have been scores of people around. And in respect of the second, in Weinberg's view, certainly, it was even more improbable, and it was said to have occurred when there actually were people around.
Like 50 people or so walking down the corridor as the choir was kind of walking down.
So Pell's lawyers were making the case that this is wildly improbable, and I'm pretty confident the prosecutor would have been saying to the jury, well, you wouldn't find that to be improbable because you might think in your experience and your knowledge that, you know, sexual offences can happen in that context.
Of course. I can see where they... Okay,
now I understand why that would be the case.
Yeah, I don't know. I it's interesting because one wonders whether what came to bear in this case is all of the extraneous stuff about Pell. You have a jury that's been exposed to... must have been exposed to so much media about
Pell. Yeah, well, let's not forget...
How can you get anyone who comes... And this wasn't a point taken in the appeal.
Very high profile.
But how can anyone come to make a decision about that without thinking about that?
Sure. Very, very
famous in Victoria and New South Wales at the time of his trial.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there's no capacity in Victoria for judge alone trials. So he do what you could do in New South Wales, which is seek a judge alone.
Interesting.
I mean, it's... I don't know, like, speaking from the point of view of a barrister, and I suspect you guys might have the same view, there's nothing, in a way, worse than appearing in a case where it's the sole word of a complainant. Because on paper, it shouldn't be a strong case. And so you never necessarily feel like you won't be able to make a defence of someone. But in a way, you live in fear of a Pell-type scenario where the sole uncorroborated word of a complainant on the basis of these intangible ideas such as credibility and demeanour mean that a person who might actually be innocent is convicted. So I just find these cases really hard. I've done a few. I don't like appearing in them much. You have to do what comes in. So it would be good to get some guidance from the High Court.
Where you're often in a position of having very limited information about matters that are highly relevant to the credibility of the person making the complaint.
But also just in terms of what you say to the jury, I'm the big bad barrister who's ripping into the victim of a crime because that victim of a crime may be lying. Now, to expose those lies means risking making someone cry, making someone break down.
And re-traumatise.
Re-traumatising them. Leaving aside the ethics of doing that, on some level, the jury is going to is sitting there saying, well, this person's just raping them again.
And there's also this quite sort of insidious dynamic where the harder you go, the more vigorously you expose inconsistencies and you put your client's case, then the prosecutor, in closing submissions, will very often say to the jury, you've seen them tested in cross-examination, you've seen, and they'll often sort of talk up your qualities as a lawyer, you've seen a very good cross-examination, it was lengthy, they put lots of things to them, and they didn't crack, they stood by their story. And you can create this sort of reverse dynamic where the harder you try and the harder you go, if you don't actually succeed in having that sort of law and order moment, which is pretty unusual.
Oh, really?
Then you can fortify the prosecutor in a way.
I mean, not in your cross-examination.
That's right. We know that.
I thought it happened every day. I thought you go in half an hour later, gong, gong. No?
No.
Got it completely wrong. Okay, well, we'll keep our eyes peeled on the future of Mr. George Pell. I am pronouncing that right, George Pell.
You are.
Let's move on to an issue that is close to Emmanuel Kirkasharian's heart, and that is the legal aid shortfall. Can you fill us in?
It's been 11 years since there's been an increase in the amount of money that people are provided to pay for their private lawyers in trials, criminal trials. The actual amounts of money that people have been provided has decreased. The amount of matters for which money has been provided has been decreased. So once upon a time, you'd get legal aid in all kinds of matters. Now, you only get them after a certain level of seriousness. For civil matters...
Or if you're pleading guilty.
So say in the local court, unless you're pleading guilty, in certain circumstances, you will not get legal aid.
So what, you sort of represent yourself?
Yep.
Okay, so
legal aid, okay, just want to just reverse back a little bit.
Yes.
Tax dollars go towards an area of state government called legal aid.
Yes.
And this legal aid pays lawyers and barristers to represent people who can't afford their services.
It employs it employs solicitors.
Okay.
Who appear for certain people.
Yep.
And it also funds private lawyers and barristers to appear for people.
Okay. To take the overflow work that the employed solicitors can't do because there's not enough.
Why is there the old saying is there's no votes in it. Is that why there's a shortfall, do you believe? Or why? I mean, why aren't they funding legal aid? We've got a backlog of cases. Judges are getting the shits. Magistrates are getting angry. Why aren't they funding it?
I think there's two things. I think that one, there's no votes in it is the view. And I think that in the bureaucracy, there is the point of view is taken that private lawyers make lots and lots of money. We don't need to fund them. They're earning so much more money than we do. Why should we fund these bastards?
Right.
So you've got this situation where there's no one in the bureaucracy who will argue for it and the politicians don't care.
Okay. What's...
And also, there is, I think, within the profession quite a good dynamic, which is to say a lot of people who are prepared to do the work, where they're effectively being paid, you know, $7 an hour or so, and prepared to at least take part of their practice or a big part of their practice and contribute in that way.
For 10 of the last 11 years, legal aid came to the Bar Association and the Bar Association said, we're not going to push for higher fees. And it's because our members take on that work and are willing to do it, in effect, as our contribution. There are people who've run murder trials in the last 2 years who've literally been, profit-wise, they've made $9 an hour. Half the minimum wage. And why did they do it? Well, because people deserve a defence. But Tim Gay, MSC, the president of the Bar Association, came out earlier this year and said, you don't have to do the work anymore, because it's just at the point where it starts affecting our mental health, it starts affecting our ability to pay the bills and survive. And the profession really can't swallow it anymore.
And it should be what I've learned is that as barristers, you have to get the work, you have to work on the work that's presented to you. Is that correct? So if these cases are brought for you, it's your obligation to pick them up.
It's, well, if you're willing to pay my fee and it's within my competence, then I have to pick it up. That's the rule, right?
Okay.
So if it's a criminal case, I have to take it on. If I'm willing to accept the fee, then that's fine. But what one can say, as I say now, is I don't accept legal aid.
Right, and that's in the instruction of the bar,
under the instruction of the Bar Association. You guys have effectively been given permission to say, push has come to shove, and the state government need to pony up now because this is at crisis point.
Yeah, I mean, the Bar Association has said that people should no longer, or barristers should no longer consider themselves obligated to accept legal aid work. And look, it's a little bit unclear what that means from the point of view of ethical regulation, because as Manny said, the cab rank rule, which is the rule that you take all the cases that come in, only applies if they're willing to pay your fee. So you have a choice at the moment about whether you accept legal aid work or not. But it's not a real choice for a lot of people, because they might not have a big flow of private work, and particularly new barristers at the bar generally don't, so they rely on legal aid to a very great extent.
Sure.
And then there's a whole lot of people out there, including myself, who do legal aid work because I just do legal aid work and I don't want to implement a rule in my practice that I don't do it. I mean, I limit the amount that I do, and I do sort of other pro bono work and ALS work, but so I do, it's a pretty small percentage now, but I still do some. And I mean, I was involved in a matter that resolved quite recently, which was a very serious criminal trial, brief of sort of two folders, so not huge but quite considerable. It ended up resolving by way of a plea of guilty to a lesser charge the Friday before, and the legal aid sort of allocation for that is $1,600, which look, probably sounds like a lot of money, except I probably did 4 to 5 days of preparation and reading for it, and then another day in court plus two conferences previously, so the best part of 6 to 8 working days.
Okay, yeah.
And then you've got your overheads. So, yeah, I mean, sure. I don't know the maths on that, but in terms of barrister work and what people are generally paid,
$1,600 for 7.
That is a very low rate of
remuneration. Sure, sure. Very absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, like, because.
Look, I mean, you guys are the punching bags, really, of because everyone goes, oh, cry me a river, guys, lawyers, boo hoo. But that is a ridiculously low return on the investment that you've put in to read and give this person a credible defence. What is an outcome that you feel is just?
I think at the first instance, what the ideal outcome is that if you're running a criminal trial, then the state pays your costs if you win the trial.
Okay.
Right? So normally, if you're having civil litigation and you win, the other side pays your costs.
Sure.
In crime, that's not the case.
Sure.
So for my money, the state should simply fund both sides. Where the state is right, that is to say you're a criminal, then we recover it from your assets if you've got any. And if you don't, we're sure you've been given a fair trial, right? And where you win, well, we've paid for you so you haven't been out of pocket. I think that's the ideal. I don't think that's achievable. I think the achievable ideal is just people being paid a reasonable hourly rate for the amount of work they do.
And an hourly
rate
that relates to the market value
of
other comparable legal services.
Yeah.
So it's hard to nominate like a number. You can nominate a number a day that we should get, and it will probably sound big, you know, to a lot of people out there.
Well, this is high-skilled work, right? Like, according to my intro, you guys are elite at the elite level.
Turn it up, Jin.
I mean, you know, so you would imagine that you'd be compensated accordingly.
The whole system benefits from having a competent, well-prepared prosecutor, a competent, well-prepared defence lawyer, and the case being run because they're both prepared in an efficient way and in a way that's fair, everyone in the community benefits from that process because it strengthens our community, the rule of law. So the idea that you send in a barrister to a serious criminal trial and pay them one day preparation in circumstances where it will inevitably involve a week to 2 weeks or more preparation to properly defend the person, that's just outrageous. And so the way that the system works currently is it's not just that the hourly rate is abysmal and hasn't been increased for 11 or 12 years, but that there's a cap on what will be allocated by way of preparation. And so, like, I've had cases where I've put in a lot of preparation ahead of the trial, prepared written submissions on pre-trial applications and various different things, which has meant that, for example, the case has resolved completely on the first day of the trial and saved the court and legal aid a two-week trial, but I will not be paid for that preparation work because there's only a one-day allocation, even though money was nominally allocated for the case for me to be in court every day. And so,
well, you should have just gone, oh, I could solve this right now, or I could sit on it, wait till tomorrow.
That's what happens.
And that's a lot of the dynamic that happens. Whereas where people turn up,
but can
and
you blame
act,
them?
Well,
they're going to get paid.
Yeah. And look, you never really know if it's happening or not.
You don't.
Sure.
But it incentivises people acting contrary to their client's interests and contrary to the interests of the whole system.
Yeah.
Of course.
The economics of it are just wrong because it does happen. And even if people are conscientiously trying, the reality is they don't have the time to prepare. So every day that you do in preparation at the start knocks two off at the end in the long cases.
Yeah. Right.
And so the economics are just wrong. It's really just ideological. And you see that when you consider not only that the rates that have been paid haven't gone up, but it's actually the things that are funded by the government and not just crime.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, law touches every part of your life. It touches when you leave your intimate partner, when you get your insurance on your car, when you buy your mobile phone, you're signing a contract. And for all of these things, you can't afford a lawyer. Tenancy. You can't afford a lawyer. Big business can afford a lawyer. Government will pay its lawyers twice what it pays its legal aid lawyers.
Right?
Oh, in cases where you're opposing the government...
For example, right?
Yeah, or in other cases where a state government agency is acting and you're acting for someone on the other side, the lawyers for the government will be paid twice as much.
And for their preparation. There's a higher rate in ICAC.
Yeah.
If you do private crown work, it's slightly higher.
Yeah,
but a huge amount, but like slightly.
That's right, but most crowns are in-house crowns, the crown prosecutors.
Mm.
And if you roundabout do the sums for the amount of work that they do, leaving aside when they're not working, they cross the state about $2,800 a day.
Okay, so when the state government is allocating their budget, right? Okay, and just a quick question, who pays judges and magistrates? Is that a state budget?
Yeah.
Allocation. So when they're dispersing their funds, do they just go yes, reduced? Is that how it works? Like,
it's not being increased. What, for 12 years, money?
Yeah.
So it's not a case of being reduced, but not increased,
and then inflation
and CPI,
reduced. Okay.
So everyone, every other lawyer.
So, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
I just want to make it perfectly clear. There is. You guys, legal aid is the whipping boy of the entire legal system. Like everything else is at a comparable rate of fairness.
Okay, so every other lawyer, including the in-house legal aid lawyers, have had their incomes go up between 22 to 25% or more, right?
Mm-hmm.
The external lawyers employed by legal aid are the whipping boys.
Mm-hmm.
So the barristers are the whipping boys.
Uh-huh.
Whipping girls. Well, yeah, indeed. The whipping people, the whipping posts.
Yep.
Right? And the solicitors, and there are tireless solicitors who pick up this work. They get paid a pittance. They have to take weeks out of their diary. And if court happens to finish early one day, they may make $100, right? And $100 bucks a day may sound like a lot of money when you think, until you think about, you've got to have a secretary, you've got to have a phone, you have all the overheads. It's crazy.
Sure. Is there any move forward to a resolution in this department, or are we just at a stalemate?
Well, we know it's been publicised that the Leader Laid Commission put up a proposal to government prior to the last budget. That proposal remains with the Attorney General under his consideration.
Any idea on an outcome on that one?
I mean, I don't hold out hope, but if it's not solved, people will strike.
Right.
Maybe not this year, but a little while from now. People are getting pretty upset.
Well, there's already cases that are being delayed, isn't that right?
3 months were blown out just a few months ago because Legal Aid wouldn't fund the lawyers. 3 months of the Supreme Court judge's diary was ripped apart.
Okay.
You think about that, costs probably, who knows how much that costs the state.
And there are people sitting in jail right now as a result of this problem.
Yeah.
Just waiting. They haven't been convicted. Yeah, they haven't been convicted. They're just sitting in jail.
Innocent people.
Mm. Yeah.
Some of whom will be acquitted.
Sure.
Yeah.
But they have to wait.
Yep.
All right, let's return to this next time. Let's move on to another case, which I have to admit I know nothing about. Once again, I have it written down as 501. I'm going to let Stephen take the role with this one. Can you please fill us in on what is going on in the 501 department?
Yeah, sure. So being my honour at the moment, and I've been involved in a large number of these cases, is the draconian provisions of Section 501 of the Migration Act. That is the section in the Migration Act that allows the minister to refuse a visa or cancel a visa on account of misconduct or criminal misconduct often. And it's been in the law in various forms for a long time, and there was very significant amendments under Tony Abbott, so back in 2014, I think it was. And they basically, the Parliament introduced a new provision in Section 501, which essentially says if you're in custody and you've been sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 12 months or more, then your visa is cancelled. It's automatically cancelled.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you can apply to revoke the cancellation, and mm-hmm. you can put to the minister why you should be able to stay in the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so in the years sort of leading up to that, so in 2013-14, there was 76 cancellations under Section 501. In 2014, there was 579. In 2016-17, there was 1,277.
Okay, so they've gone through the roof. And so
it's absolutely skyrocketed.
Okay.
And not unusual, I think, for anyone who's got a criminal practice, to come across these unfortunate people who often have lived in Australia basically all their lives. So you might have someone that's come to Australia.
But they're still on a visa? How does that
work? And they are still on a visa because their parents never applied for Australian citizenship for them.
Right.
A lot of them are people who never necessarily turned their mind to it. Some of them thought that they were Australian citizens.
Right.
Some indeed have voted in elections and been treated as Australian citizens.
Voted in elections?
Yep.
Yeah, how has that happened?
Yep, there's been cases like that. People have managed to get on the roll.
Sure.
But not actually have been citizens, have just been permanent residents.
Okay.
It's been a particular issue for New Zealand citizens because there's so many here,
right.
And a large proportion of the 501 cancellations are Kiwis.
Mm-hmm.
There was that case about the deportation of that man to PNG recently, and that had quite a complicated sort of factual scenario as well because of Australia's relationship to PNG and certain citizenship kind of rules in relation to people that were from there. So he, I think, what his grandparents and parents and maybe great-grandparents were all Australian.
Yeah.
He came to Australia as like a three-year-old or something.
Yeah, there's been a number of cases involving citizens of parts of the people from parts of the Torres Strait and PNG.
Mm.
And some of those people have been of Indigenous heritage of Australia, but for various complicated reasons are not actually citizens of Australia.
Oh,
and there's one case that I recall where the person was born in PNG prior to independence, moved to Australia, I think, prior to independence, occurring in PNG in 75, had Australian citizenship at that time because people in PNG, because it was a colony, were Australian citizens. Under the transitional arrangements as part of the transition to independence, lost Australian citizenship, was in Australia, didn't realise he'd lost Australian citizenship, and then committed a criminal offence. I think in his case it was some sort of aggravated driving offence or something. It wasn't top-tier criminality.
Who's the bastard that finds out about the, oh, hey, there's a legal loophole here in that we've just gone through your records, and, like, how would that come up?
So courts and jails and I think police as well report to a part of the federal government that I think is called the Character Assessment Office or something like that.
Right.
And they report outcomes of cases to them, and there's a database, and they work out who's not a citizen.
Can I ask a question and interrupt here? Because these people are being deported. So you would assume as an Australian citizen you'd be afforded the rights of a court. That would be just, right? But this isn't a court, isn't that right?
That's right. So they're subject.
What are they? What are they called?
Yeah. So these people are subject to mandatory cancellation.
Okay.
They can apply
mandatory
to the minister.
Okay.
To have the visa
mandatory
reinstated.
Mandatory cancellation
of
their visa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But isn't that right that there's some sort of tribunal or something that's been set up that is not a court of law, and that's what determines? Yes, this person is to be deported. Is that right?
No.
Did I read that wrong?
So generally, a decision to cancel a visa on character is either made by the minister or a delegate of the minister.
Oh, really? Yeah. Straight from the office?
Yeah, sometimes.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, sometimes. And it depends on the particular situation as to whether they can appeal to a tribunal and have the decision actually reconsidered.
Okay.
In some situations they can't.
Okay.
But what they can do is apply to the federal court to say that the decision was unlawful.
Uh-huh.
And there's a whole complicated body of law around this concept of jurisdictional error. So if an administrative decision is afflicted in various ways by error, then it's a decision outside of jurisdiction and the federal court will set it aside and send it back to the minister.
Right.
And, I mean, I've certainly been involved in a lot of those. And the sort of general trend that you see with this government is often very unfair and strained reasoning by the minister to find any possible way to ensure that the person is deported.
Well, how do you go from 57 deportations in 1 year to 2 years later, 1,200 plus? I mean, so someone's sitting there, it's their job to write these all down.
Some faceless bureaucrat.
Doing what, 20 a day?
Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those are mandatory.
Right, okay.
Yeah, they actually happen by effect of law. Yeah.
Okay, so you've committed a crime, you get slotted into this. Right.
But a delegate still has to actually make the decision.
Yeah, right.
But the decision is compelled, and then the person can reapply.
That's the 12-month rule,
that's right.
Isn't it? Yeah, so if you are convicted of a crime and receive a term of imprisonment of 12 months or more, that's an automatic ticker box, including a suspended sentence, so if you don't.
But if you think about what our society says, it says we're not going to send you to jail for 5 years unless you've committed a crime and we've had a trial and we've thought about whether or not it's fair and right that you should do 5 years in prison. What the law now says is if you do 12 months, then some guy who you don't know is going to be your girl is going to be forced to tick a box that rips you out of your family and sends you overseas where to a country that you may have never lived in. And that is the amount of decision-making time we're going to spend on that. We're not going to do it in open court. We're not going to have a big discussion about whether or not it's fair and right that you should do that. We're not going to take any of that into consideration.
So bizarre.
Could a solution to this be some form of legislation, which I'm sure will never be introduced in this term of government, that would say, hey, we should put a sunset on citizenship, but, you know, if you've lived in this country for
permanent
residency. Yeah, so yeah. Except
transition to citizenship.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of, like
an automatic citizenship upon living here for a certain period of time. Is that what you mean? Yeah.
Yes. Is that what would save these poor saps from a situation like this?
Yeah, that would be one way of dealing with it. Another way would be to make the law more flexible so that you're not imposing mandatory cancellation on such a broad range of people.
Yes.
And to have actually considered decisions made as to when it's actually necessary for a person to go. I mean, you can have people serving a term of imprisonment for 12 months for a driving offence. For example, drive disqualified. It's not a good thing to do, but it's not a particularly serious criminal offence or not something that, that necessarily poses a danger to the community.
Yeah.
And you might have been in Australia since you were two. You will have your visa immediately cancelled because of that. It's such an awful punishment. It's such a draconian system.
Yeah.
And I think also disproportionately impacting on vulnerable communities and families.
And it's interesting to pose this scenario in the context of the whole citizenship saga that happened in Parliament, where it was revealed that so many members of Parliament had no idea what their citizenship status was in relation to different countries and so on. And a lot of people, particularly people in vulnerable situations or from migrant communities, are not equipped to know what their citizenship status are or trust their parents that a certain state of affairs exists or so on. So,
they didn't negligently kill someone in the car. But it's interesting. I think the decision should just be given to the sentencing judge.
That's interesting.
And just give them... The sentencing judge knows what the person's like, can be given all of the information, and in the context of punishing this person, can decide the next step, which is this person... Should this person stay in Australia?
Do a character assessment
there. Yeah. Oh, that's what happens. It's sentencing. Your character assessment is done before you decide what you're going to do to the person.
Have you ever had a successful case in this area, or is it just because it's mandatory?
Yeah, so I've had a few where we've successfully challenged a ministerial decision not to revoke or a ministerial decision to cancel. But you don't ultimately sort of necessarily win the war because... the matter then just goes back to the delegate or the tribunal or the minister and it's redetermined.
Really?
Yeah, so you can win your judicial review, which is what's it called, but ultimately lose the battle.
All right, okay. This has been enlightening for me. If we can, we want to end on maybe, you know, just something that you're excited about. I think we should end it on because, you know, it's a heavy job that you guys perform. What are you reading a book? Are you seeing a film? Are you engaged in an album that you're listening to that has got you, you know, just lay it out. Manny, what have you got?
What have I got? I'm working from about 3 a.m. till about 12 p.m. every day at the moment.
What's up?
That's what I'm doing.
Is it you going home going, holy shit, I get to order a pizza tonight. Fuck, that's awesome. Like, is there any, just...
I'm having a party on Saturday.
There you go. Oh,
bring on spring.
Very interested. We sound like real losers. We just, like, we're not, like, watching a good movie. We're not reading a good book.
Because you don't have the time. Is that what the issue
is? I'm reading a book called Things Hidden Since the Dawn of Time or something.
Okay.
Which is an analysis of religion.
Okay.
And why religion is prohibitive. And it's done from the perspective of Dawkins, sort of mimetic.
Cool.
I don't know if it's cool.
Okay. We don't want to go down that hole.
No.
This has been a fantastic, enlightening episode. I really appreciate your time. Emmanuel Kirkasharian, Stephen Lawrence, Felicity Graham. I'm Jim Means. Guys, this has been The Wigs, episode 1. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Please like The Wigs on Facebook at The Wigs Podcast. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, produced by Jim Mintz.